Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Stephen Farrar, who is the senior lecturer at the Centre for Applied Jungian Studies in Johannesburg, South Africa. He became passionate about Jungian psychology after experiencing it as radically life-changing when he first encountered it in the late 90s. Stephen's interests are consciousness, meaning, and the individuation project. He has a BA honours degree in philosophy from the University of Witwatersrand and a master's degree in Jungian and post-Jungian studies from the Centre of Psychoanalytic Studies at the University of Essex in the UK. He's here to talk to us today about Carl Jung, Jungian psychology, its relevance today, how we can apply it, and how it might relate to the Middle Way. Hello, Stephen. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you very much, Barry. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, well, could we begin, Stephen, by you maybe telling us something of your background and how you first became interested in Carl Jung and Jungian psychology?
Barry, I came to it through a fairly unusual series of events, I would say.
Yeah.
My background was not in psychology. I was not practicing as a psychologist, and I didn't have any particular interest in psychology. And what happened to me, this is around about the year 1999, just before the millennium. I was at a particularly low point in my life, and circumstances led me to a school in Johannesburg that was offering Jungian studies in a very unconventional fashion, in a fashion that was not aimed specifically at clinicians, although there were clinicians that attended,
yeah.
But it was aimed at the general public as a way of disseminating Jung's collected works. And I came to this encounter at a time that I was badly in need of some guidance. It was sort of a low point in my life. And I studied with a man by the name of Martin de Chatillon, who has sadly passed away about 2 years ago, but who had ran the school in Johannesburg for about 25 years.
Okay.
And I studied with him for about 5 or 6 years, and it was it had a massive impact on me, and it was certainly a life-changing experience for me. And it's ultimately become a lifelong passion and now a vocation.
Okay, and how was it life-changing? How did your life change through the engagement with his work?
It gave me a language. It gave me a language, Jungian psychology, Jungian studies, whatever, the collected works, Jung's work, gave me a language with which to interpret my inner experience, what I was dealing with, what I was grappling with, and also the world as well. It gave me a language with which to understand both the world, my interpersonal encounters, but I suppose most importantly, most significantly, my own intrapsychic experiences. And using this language, I was able to reframe my identity and reframe my experience and ultimately reframe my life.
Great. Okay, well, we can explore some of those avenues as we move on into the talk. But maybe for those listeners who don't know much about Jung, could you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Carl Gustav Jung, born in 1875, died in 1961. A Swiss psychiatrist and psychologist, and a very early and very enthusiastic adopter of the psychoanalytic approach, very heavily influenced by Freud, not only Freud, other people working with sort of a depth psychological approach, but most significantly Freud, who then went on later on to break with Freud and to form his own school of depth psychology, which was originally known, named complex psychology, very briefly, but it was named complex psychology, which was later on then changed to analytical psychology, but is most commonly referred to simply as Jungian psychology.
Yeah.
And this has become a global movement. He is one of the founding fathers of depth psychology, and I would say perhaps second only to Freud in terms of the influence he's had in the depth psychological field.
Mm-hmm.
And continues to be widely practiced throughout the world today by Jungian analysts, and in the last sort of 20 years or so, as a sort of a method or a lens, you know, applied to cultural studies, critical theory, that sort of thing as well.
Okay. You mentioned that, you know, he was very influenced by Freud, but he moved on from him. Why did he do that? In what ways did he do that?
Well, the relationship between Freud and Jung was very close. Jung was the heir apparent to the psychoanalytic legacy, so appointed by Freud himself. And during the years of their association, roughly from about 1906, 1907 to around about 1912, 1913, they had a very, very close relationship. They exchanged a significant amount of correspondence in addition to their personal encounters. Their correspondence has subsequently been published. But ultimately, theoretically at least, the point of departure was Jung's discovery, if I can refer to it that way, of the collective unconscious, this notion that there's this collective, objective, impersonal psychic substrate that cannot be traced back to the developmental history of the subject. And his exploration of mythology and mythological motifs and the idea that these had a significant impact and influence on our psychology saw him part ways with Freud's theory, which really focused on the drives and theory of libido, and specifically the Oedipal complex. And this became a theoretical point of departure. Freud saw Jung as perhaps going outside of the classical psychoanalytic approach. He sort of criticized him as being somewhat mystical in his approach, and ultimately it led to a fairly acrimonious split between the two men. But if one studies the history of their relationship, and there's been a significant study done on this, it wasn't only theoretical. There was perhaps personal factors involved as well. This was a very intense and close relationship, and somehow the glass broke at some point between the two of them. So there was conceptual and theoretical differences, but I would say there were some personal issues involved as well.
So it was Freud's assumptions about materialism and as you say, and his reduction of desire to sexuality that he had difficulty with.
Yeah, Freud of course had the sexual drive, the sexual instinct as the primary human driver, and his theoretical edifice was principally built around that. Jung accepted that in principle. He accepted the notion of sexuality as being a very, very significant human driver, a significant factor in motivation in human action. He largely accepted Freud's theories, but he wasn't happy that it was exclusive. He felt that the exclusivity that Freud attached to sexuality and to the sexual instinct was an overstatement of the position, and that our psychology had other significant drivers and themes playing out, not only the sexual one.
Yeah, and doesn't that also in some ways highlight a difference between the two, that arguably Jung was more provisional in his outlook, whereas Freud tended to form his views in often quite absolute terms?
Yes, I think that would be a fair statement. And I think that's borne out by the research that's been done into their split and their positions.
Okay. To what degree do you think Jung's contribution is philosophical, you know, to the extent that he offered us new and helpful ways of understanding and assessing our beliefs and the ways we interpret experience?
It's a big question.
Yeah.
It's a big question. There's some debate on this amongst Jungian scholars, whether Jung can be regarded as a philosopher and offering some sort of philosophical approach, not only as a psychologist. In terms of classical or recognized philosophical approaches, his approach would probably be that of phenomenology. A very well-known Jungian scholar from South Africa, interestingly enough, by the name of Dr. Roger Brooke, wrote a text on this, Jung as a phenomenologist, and described Jung's approach as essentially phenomenological, which does seem to be convergent with and consistent with Jung's own description of his position. He often uses this word, this idea. He describes himself as using a phenomenological approach. But I think to your broader question, Did he offer us some sort of philosophy? My personal position is that he did, in that he recognized the centrality of the psyche and the role of the psyche in the development of any philosophical approach, and in terms of the tool that the philosopher uses in the development of his philosophical theories. So this notion that everything starts with psyche, that psyche cannot be surgically removed from any abstracted philosophical treatise, because ultimately it is a product of psyche. So I think this idea does have philosophical value. I don't think that Jung is exclusive in this approach, but he certainly helps us to understand how the psyche and how the unconscious plays out into all our value systems, all our belief systems. And this word you used early on of provisional, that perhaps one has to be careful of being too absolute, too certain in any approach, simply because of the fact that it's always difficult to know what role the unconscious plays. There's a conscious element, but there's always an unconscious unknown element. And so one should be wary. There's a particular line I can quote for you that's quite nice. From Jung, he says, "I, for my part, prefer the precious gift of doubt, so as not to violate the virginity of things beyond our ken." Which I always like. That's a nice line in terms of summing up.
That's fantastic. And just in relation to this, Jung saw himself very much as a man of science, and science is very much linked with the idea of provisionality and, you know, having a theory and trying to falsify it, and then your theory becomes better through that exposure to experience. To what degree did this position lead to a genuine objectivity of approach from Jung, do you think?
The truth is, Barry, I don't know. I'll give you a very provisional answer, but the honest answer is I cannot say with any degree of certainty.
Okay.
You know, I think it was Popper who criticized Freud very heavily on this point, and the notion that psychoanalysis is not scientific, that it can never be disproved. It always has some sort of fallback position where it were I to make some sort of claim about your psychology and you were to deny it, I would then always fall back to the notion of, well, you're exhibiting resistance. This is a classic theory. So you're sort of in a situation where, you know, once I diagnose you, it's quite difficult to undiagnose yourself within the theoretical edifice. I think that Jung aspired to a scientist. He certainly, he was a medical doctor. He was a psychiatrist, and he certainly considered himself to be a scientist, and he aspired to a scientific approach. But how much, you know, how much the empirical data influenced him and helped him to refine his theory is a question that is very hotly debated in the field, and it's a difficult one to answer. You know, the nature of psychoanalysis, the science of the psyche, if you will, particularly in the field of depth psychology, doesn't seem to submit itself to the same sort of empirical and data-based evidence that we have in the hard sciences and the physical sciences. So although it aspires to a scientific approach, and it is a theory that constantly seeks to refine itself, how close it adheres to science as defined by the philosophy of science or as defined by hard scientists is a debatable question.
Sure. Well, I suppose when you say hard scientists, I think we commonly assume that we're talking there about scientific naturalism. But, I mean, for instance, he wasn't afraid of private experience or material from cultural or religious traditions. I mean, didn't he arguably try to convince scientific naturalists that phenomena as remote from publicly verifiable, reproducible proof as the unconscious or the archetypes should be taken seriously in scientific terms? I don't know if he achieved that, but he tried, didn't he?
He certainly did. He certainly did. And he made a very significant contribution in that sense. But whether that contribution or how widely that contribution has been assimilated into even the humanities, let's not even talk about scientific naturalism. Even the humanities, even social studies, anthropological studies, is, I would say, still an open question. Perhaps Jung has not yet fully come into his own in that sense, but I would agree with you that he did aspire to gift this work to the natural scientific community and to make a contribution through his research and through his through his writing. How successful he was, I don't know.
Okay, moving on then. Now, an aspect of Jung's work that I know that you're particularly interested in, we in the Middle Way Society feel arguably the biggest contribution to our understanding of the Middle Way made by Jung is the concept of individuation. Could you tell us something about that, and first of all, and how that relates to your own experience?
I would say the concept of individuation is certainly central to Jung's work. It's perhaps amongst his most central ideas.
Yeah.
Certainly amongst his most central aspirational ideas.
Could you actually, again for the layperson, could you just give a quick snapshot of what individuation is as well?
I will endeavor to do so. So individuation is the concept that our psychologies possess, each individual psychology has a unique idiosyncratic structure and telos. And individuation is the process of increasingly exploring that uniqueness and those points of difference, so that the individual psychology is increasingly differentiated from the mass mind, from the collective, and an individual path is explored. And ideally, it has at its notion as well that the individuation process is the pursuit of the ideal path for the individual. In other words, a life path or an expression of the individual that is most ideally suited to their own peculiar, particular and idiosyncratic psychology.
Okay, and then, so to paraphrase that, are we saying our experience comprises a variety of energies, symbols and beliefs that may be in conflict, and individuation is about reconciling them, bringing them into, rechanneling them to an extent with this idea of progress?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement, Barry. I think that's certainly a very important element of the individuation process. So this idea of, to put it in perhaps into Jungian terms, this idea of seeking wholeness, of seeking to heal the fragmentation of the psyche. So this understanding that the psyche naturally has opposing polar positions that are seemingly in conflict with one another.
Yeah.
And the process of individuation, as you say, would be the process of reconciling, of bringing these opposite positions into some sort of coexistence, some sort of relationship. And most significantly, without collapsing one or other of the polar opposites, so that this consciousness, for example, for Jung then, is the facing of opposites, where they face one another. That for him is an expression of consciousness. And of course, consciousness is a central element of individuation. So one brings in the explicit position, the conscious position, as it were, and reconciles this to the implicit or unconscious position that is possibly in conflict with the explicit conscious position, but without denying one or other side. So without throwing the baby out of the bathwater, so to speak.
Sure. So could you give us a practical example of individuation that you know someone could attempt in their everyday lives, or maybe something that from your own experience?
I would say that a very practical example or an accessible example is this idea of a quality or a personality trait that the individual finds to be undesirable for one or another reason. However, notwithstanding the fact that it is adjudged and seen as undesirable, it continues to persist. You know, this cliche, what you resist persists, but there's a truth in it from a psychoanalytic perspective.
Yep.
And so an exercise in individuation would be, instead of resisting or opposing this seemingly undesirable characteristic or trait, that one seeks to find expression for it in your life in such a way that it is that it adds value or it reconciles itself to the sort of meta-ethical position of the individual. But that act of reconciliation, that act of compromise, if you will, is not all one-way traffic. So it's not the simplistic idea that I redeem my negative characteristics by making them good and polite and pure and respectable, so to speak. It's that I need to face that in myself which I've deemed to be undesirable, and there needs to be a reconciliation between both the conscious and unconscious positions, such that both are altered through that engagement. But in simple terms then, that I need to take the fact that this quality lives in me, going back to your question, I need to take the fact that this quality lives in me seriously, and I need to engage with it seriously. I need to treat it with a certain respect, with a certain reverence.
Yeah.
And in so doing, enter into a dialogue with it and seek to include it in my life in one or other way in which it can be expressed rather than being suppressed or repressed.
Okay. So this obviously has huge implications beyond the medical model of psychotherapy. For example, perhaps as the basis of moral objectivity. You know, that in the sense that the more, I'm going to use the term integrated, because that's maybe the verb that goes within individuation, the more integrated our judgments are, the more objective they are likely to be. To what extent would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that would be consistent with Jung, and certainly with Jung definitely, and also psychoanalytic theory, in the sense that if by integration you mean conscious, you see, I would say that using this term integration, but perhaps that's interchangeable with this notion of making unconscious content conscious. So the more integrated it is, the less biased or prejudiced my view would be, and presumably the greater access I would have to objectivity, simply because the less distorted my lens is going to be.
Yeah.
So I would think that would be a fair statement. I think that would be consistent with psychoanalytic theory, yes.
Yeah. Could it be also seen as taking within the limitations of our physicality and our psyche, taking into account as much as realistically possible when we're making a judgment? Could that be congruent with what we're talking about?
Yes, I think that's fair. I would maybe phrase it like this from the Jungian perspective that I think is consistent with what you're saying. It's a slightly different phrasing. It's the notion that when I'm looking at, when I'm considering any situation, typically I will adopt a particular perspective. So if I'm considering a new enterprise, if I'm considering a relationship, or I'm looking at the values of one or other situation, usually there's a default ideological position that it's good or bad, or that it should be done or it shouldn't be done, or it's going to have a positive or a negative outcome or whatever it may be. And the good Jungian practice there would be to consider the opposite, to consider what the alternative is to one's ideological position. That, look, perhaps this there may be some profit in this enterprise. This enterprise may bring maybe of some value to the community, to the country, whatever it may be. But at what price does it come? What is its shadow, to put it in a Jungian sense? That
yeah.
it always carries in its ambit an opposite. Nothing is one-sided. For Jung, one-sidedness was sort of a hallmark of the unconscious, of barbarism. So you're speaking about a kind of a plural perspective, sort of a multifaceted perspective. But just in to put it into a Jungian frame, I would say that one looks at the opposite of one's ideological or one's conscious position, and tries to consider both of these aspects informing one's judgment, as opposed to taking a kind of a narrow one-sided approach.
Yeah, well, that relates very much to a middle way perspective in that sense. We have a preference, maybe for the term integration rather than individuation, even though we're talking about the same thing, mainly because we feel this makes it clear that integration is not only the process of psychological development in an individual, but it can also be applied at a social level. I don't know, what are your thoughts on that and the ethical and political, potential ethical and political applications of integration in general?
Yes, I mean, I like that, and I think integration is a useful term, not only in terms of the work that you're involved in with the middle way society, but also from the psychological perspective. So certainly in terms of the individual, the process of individuating is a process of integration, of integrating diverse aspects of self, of integrating aspects that have been denied previously, of integrating unconscious aspects. And I think your comparison to the social sphere, for me, it resonates. And I would say that, yes, if one looks at the collective, if one looks at society as displaying in some sense characteristics that are not entirely different from the individual, that the greater the capacity of the society, of the community, to integrate differing perspectives, to integrate aspects of the society that may be marginalized or may be denied, one would certainly imagine that that society's ability to function optimally and in a healthy way and ideally would be increased. I mean, I guess that one has to look at it as an aspirational process. I mean, it's a never-ending process because, of course, you know, it's perhaps a continuum rather than a destination. But yes, I do think that the process of integration is one that ultimately leads to the growth of that community.
Yeah, and again, another resonant concept that you expressed there was this idea of through individuation or integration, there are no final goals, that you are on this continuum. That's I very much relate to that.
Absolutely. I mean, when we talk about even, you know, when we talk about this notion of individuation, if we understand the notion of individuation, it would be a misnomer or a misconception to think of an individual as individuated. It's a process of individuating naturally.
Yeah.
As long as one is alive and one puts oneself to the job at hand, one applies oneself to this project, one is presumably in the process of individuating. It's a lifelong process rather than a goal or a destination.
Yeah, great. Okay. And then for us, Jung's other huge contribution, well, to the middle way, we feel is the development of the concept of archetypes. Now, my understanding, and there's been a lot of confusion about how archetypes should be interpreted. Could we try and unpack that a little bit? And I'd be interested in what your take is on their importance and value, especially from a practical perspective.
Of course, a very central idea in Jung's work and in Jungian psychology. I think one cannot really understand Jung's work without understanding the notion of archetypes, that the psyche is not only individual, but it has this universal objective or collective aspect to it, and that each individual psychology, each individual's expression is an individual and particular expression of a universal or an archetypal, or in Jungian terms, archetypal form. So certainly your archetypes are central to the theory. And in terms of its implication, well, its implication is that everything that I may be or you may be grappling with as individuals are not only our individual destiny, it's not only our individual burden or challenge or our individual puzzle to be solved, but it also has this universality to it. It has this objectivity to it that transcends our individual destinies and our individual psyches. And so then one starts to understand that cultural narratives, fable, mythologies, literature, the arts are all sources that one can draw on in terms of seeking to find expression, seeking to find inspiration, in terms of the challenges that each individual is facing, because each individual ultimately is part of a collective, is part of an objective continuum. And so what we are dealing with is only in part personal, yeah. That it has this universal objective root. And if we are willing to take the time to study history, to study literature, to study the various cultural gifts that we've been given, that one will almost invariably find in one form or another the challenge that we as individuals are grappling with. And so that's the idea that that each of our lives has not only a personal but it has a universal character, and that we can and appreciate that that parameterizes us, it encloses us within a certain structure. Our freedom is not absolute, but at the same time, it offers us the comfort and the possibility of drawing on the experience of others that have come before us and those around us in terms of trying to understand what it is that we are dealing with as individuals.
Sure, yeah. Just going back to what you were saying right at the beginning of the talk, Stephen, that it provided you, Jungian psychology provides you with a useful language. I'm thinking from my own experience with archetypes that how they've been helpful is that, you know, maybe you might be really pissed off with someone at work, your boss or something, and then you've got this sort of shadow view of them, like a, you know, a bastard or whatever you want. And there's a projection going on of this archetype. And, you know, when you catch yourself doing that, then you can recognize that you're seeing only a very partial view of that person. And I found that very helpful. Does that make sense to you?
No, quite. Sure, of course. There's the notion of projection, that what I see out there ultimately is an aspect of my own soul, is an aspect of my own psyche.
Yeah.
And that it's subjectively distorted. I mean, going back to what you're saying, that through the process of integrating those projections, for example, this is the kind of the path to psychological wholeness and healing. But yes, certainly the recognition that what I see out there and what I'm grappling with, in some sense, is always an aspect of myself.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the other thing that I find very practically helpful is because they allow us to distinguish between meaningful symbols that are found, as you say, universally because of their psychic function, and metaphysical truths, or arguably absolutes. So God, for example, can be very meaningful to a person in an archetypal experiential sense without that person having to believe in God.
Yes, that's nicely put, Barry. Yeah, so I mean, Jung puts it very nicely there. I mean, this was, of course, a very big issue for him, and he grappled with this, let's say, throughout his whole life and certainly throughout his whole career. And it's this notion that God, for example, is an absolute reality in the sense that God is a psychic reality. Whether or not there is a metaphysical presence in the cosmos or in creation of something that we may term God is, as you say, a metaphysical presupposition, which it seems that it's very difficult to verify one way or another. But what we can verify, what we do have access to, is the symbol, as you put it. It's the archetype, the fact that God is a psychic reality, and it lives in our psyches. Let me say that he lives in our psyches, assuming one's view of God is masculine, of course. And that is a psychic truth. That is a phenomenological truth,
yeah.
To put it in book sense. So yes, that's a nice point. I really like what you're saying there, that symbols and archetypes have a reality independent of their metaphysical basis.
Yeah, it's like reading a fairy story by the Brothers Grimm. You know, those stories can be incredibly meaningful, and those archetypes can have real power without obviously believing in the
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, so one can be liberated from the literal truth. That's one recognizes that there's a psychic truth, a symbolic truth that is independent from the literal historical truth of the narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
And can be dealt with, yeah, independently and very usefully in that way.
Yeah. What was it? He said something that I don't believe in God, but I know God, or something. I can't remember the actual.
Yeah, wonderful story. Interview with John Freeman on Face to Face towards the end of his life, when Jung is a very old man, and Freeman asks him, Dr. Jung, after all these years, after all the study, you know, do you now believe in God? And Jung answered, he said, well, it's a difficult question to answer because I no longer need to believe. I know that God exists. And then not in the interview, but later on in I think in The Statesman, he went on to qualify it by saying that naturally what he meant was that at least God exists as a psychic truth.
Yeah, so it was meaningful to him.
Yes. Meaningful, and not only meaningful, but real.
It has a
real substantial existence when viewed psychically or phenomenologically. And we have to see that as separate from, let's say, some sort of material or ontological or metaphysical truth.
Yeah, and this ties in very much with, I don't know if you've come across this personally, Stephen, but embodied meaning theory. That we have, we actually have these metaphors and archetypes actually hardwired into our neural circuitry, you know, the God archetype, and, you know, I'm sure.
I haven't come across that. I mean, I'm not familiar with the work or the field, but certainly, of course, that's completely consistent and resonant with Jungian theory in terms of what did you refer to it, embodied?
It's in embodied meaning theory by Lakoff and Johnson. I'll send you the link.
That'd be great. Thank you. Yeah. That's...
Okay. Right. Jungian ideas and practices have by and large been associated within the medical model of psychoanalysis and therapy. However, the goal of your center, the Center of Applied Jungian Studies, is to make Jungian psychology accessible to all. So I was just wondering if you could tell us something about the center, how it was set up, and how Jungian practices can be helpful to everybody, and also how the center tries to realize these objectives.
I think Jungian psychology has a fairly unique characteristic in that although Jung himself was a psychiatrist, and although he worked with mentally ill and mentally distressed patients, it ultimately is a psychology that is not tied to pathology. It doesn't have as its central focus the treatment of pathology. It rather has as its central focus this process that we've been speaking about of individuation, of self-realization, perhaps, to use an Eastern term.
Yeah.
And so in that sense then, Jungian psychology has a value that extends way beyond clinical practice, way beyond the treatment of pathology. And the way that I personally encountered Jung's work, as I mentioned earlier on, was outside of a clinical environment. I mean, subsequently, I have, spent many years in, working with clinicians, working with Jungian analysts, just to kind of ensure that my understanding of the theory is what I'd like to believe it is. But the way I encountered it was outside of the clinical environment, and the way that we teach it is outside of a clinical environment, in the belief that Jung's work goes beyond pathology, goes beyond the treatment of sickness.
Yeah.
It is a treatment for the soul, as it were, and it is something about enabling and facilitating this process of becoming, of individuating and of integrating these diverse aspects of ourselves, and ultimately realizing the fullest and optimal expression of ourselves in the world. So that idea has informed the work that we do in the center. The center was formalized about 5 years ago. When I returned from the University of Essex after I did my master's degree. And we are geographically based in South Africa, in Johannesburg, and we teach real-world courses in South Africa, but we now have a fairly substantial global community of students. And these are people from all walks of life. Some of them are in the psychotherapeutic field, but they're certainly not limited to the psychotherapeutic field, that seek to use Jung's work as a model, as a theory, if you want, in which to understand themselves better and in which to individuate.
Okay, we see integration stroke individuation in some ways as the middle way inside out. And by that I mean, rather than just avoiding dogmatic beliefs on either side, integration brings together experiential beliefs and energies that at first were unnecessarily opposed. Each supports the other, because it's only by avoiding metaphysical beliefs that cannot be integrated that we can make integration possible. Now, I don't know what your understanding, if any, of the middle way is, but what is your understanding in the middle way, if you've got one, and how does it relate to what I just said there and what we've been talking about in general?
Look, I apologize in advance if my understanding is somewhat simplistic. So
fine.
I'll just express it to the very best of my ability. My understanding, I think, is probably consistent with what I said earlier on, that essentially one is seeking to avoid, in the middle way, one is seeking to avoid a polarized, dogmatic, and concretized sort of fundamentalist position. And one is keeping oneself open to not only to the opposite, but to the possibilities of evolution, of change, of refinement, of new learning. But I particularly liked what, I won't try to repeat what you said, but I particularly liked what you said just now about, sorry, Barry, can you give me one moment? Is it possible? I've got two dogs in here. I just need to get rid of them. Otherwise, they're going to come across on your, out. My apologies for the interruption.
No, was that the animus?
That was the animus, yes. Two of them. So I'll just go back to this. So picking up on your idea of integration and of how opposites can in fact support each other and avoid a, I mean, I don't know if you use this idea of a metaphysical collapse, but certainly avoid an ideological or an ethical or the collapse of a position. I really like that there's a value in the tension of opposites, to put it in a Jungian sense, that consciousness is about holding the tension of opposites. And although there's a tremendous desire to slip into, because there's a comfort in having an absolute belief or having a one-sided position, that this evolution of consciousness requires us to hold the middle way, as you put it. So that would be my understanding. I'm not sure, you'll tell me how sort of close it is. Or
that sounds pretty good to me, Stephen. This Jungian process, would you say that it has a sort of dialectical element to it?
Very much so, yes. I would say it is a dialectical process. There's been some fascinating work done by the Jungian scholar, very prominent Jungian, very controversial, but very prominent Jungian scholar and analyst, Wolfgang Gigerich, around this dialectical approach. But I would say that he articulates what is a perhaps an unspoken truth in Jungian's analysis and Jung's approach to psychology, and that, yes, that consciousness is, and this individuation process is most definitely dialectical in character. That the very character of consciousness in Jungian psychology is dialectical. So I would say that is, yes, I would strongly agree with that position.
Okay. And my last question, Stephen, it's just a practical one, really. If people wanted to find out more about your work and the centre in terms of websites or gaining access to it, how would they go about it?
Yes, they can find us on the web. The URL is very simple, appliedjung.com. And then on social media, we have a fairly big presence on Facebook, and that is Facebook/ApplietJung. So very simple, appliedjung.com or Facebook/ApplietJung. You can go to our Facebook page or to our website, and there, you know, if you follow us, like our page, or subscribe to our newsletter, and we'll keep you updated with what we're doing and what's coming out.
Great. Okay. Well, it's been really fascinating talking to you, Stephen, and good luck with the centre and everything. I think it's great what you're doing. Thanks for giving up your time to talk to me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me, Barry, and all the best with your work. And I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Smash it.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.